Welcome to the Upland Nation. My name is Scott Linden. I'm the host of the show, as well as Wing Shooting USA, the television show. If you're a viewer, I appreciate that. Great program in store for you here in the podcast today. A little bit of everything. If you're interested in how the world is treating us or how we should react to that or maybe take our own action, we have some great guys from the Sportsman's Alliance to talk about all the issues and what we might be able to do there. It's opening weekend for me and Flick and all my hunting partners who I've been training with all summer. So if I'm a little bit excited, I apologize in advance for that. But lots to talk about in that regard, including, hey, the best single malt scotch I've found in a while. We'll get back to that if we got time later in the broadcast. But right now, just a quick reminder that we have two guests from the Sportsman's Alliance. We've got a public access tip, so if you want to put some boot leather in, you can do it for free. Hunting strategy and a dog handling tip, and of course, a quiz and the Upland Trivia Prize right after this, which is our thanks to our sponsors, sageandbreaker.com. These folks make the highest quality gun cleaning and gun care products around. You know, if there was a Filson in the gun cleaning and gun care department, it would be these guys. And in fact, some of their gear is enclosed in, you know, packaging much like that. And ESPAmerica.com. Remember, hearing loss is cumulative. I wear mine in the field as well as on the range, and there's a whole bunch of reasons for that. Go to ESPAmerica.com and learn more about them. Without further ado, let's welcome to the Upland Nation podcast two gentlemen from the Sportsman's Alliance, Brian Lynn, the Vice President of Marketing and Communications, and Bruce Tague, the Vice President of Government Affairs. Gentlemen, thanks for being on the program.
Thank you for having us on, Scott.
Thanks, Scott. Glad to be here.
This is going to be a lot of fun. Brian, you and I go way back in a lot of ways. We won't go there, though. No, nothing unsavory there, everybody, please. But we've crossed paths and worked with the same organizations once or twice or 100 times. I can't remember how many it is.
Yeah, back 20 years.
Brian, Vice President and tell us a little bit about what the Sportsman's Alliance is and what you do.
Yeah, so we were formed about 40 years ago, 42 years ago, something like that. And we were formed specifically to protect hunting, fishing, and trapping from the animal rights movement. In the 70s, when the animal rights movement really started abusing the legislative and ballot initiative process, and there wasn't an organization out there to counteract them. And so some guys from Ohio got together when they tried to pass a ballot initiative to ban trapping in Ohio, fought them, beat them, and then other states started calling like, hey, how do we take care of this? And so the Sportsman's Alliance was founded, and we work in all 50 state legislatures, state and federal court, and at the ballot box, and specifically to protect us from Humane Society of the United States, PETA, Sierra Club, Center for Biological Diversity, all these different groups that want to take away methods and means of hunting.
Yeah, I remember the day I was at a Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation elk camp back in the late 80s, I think, when we all learned about you, when we went up against that first Barren Cougar Hunting with Hounds initiative. Those were the good old days for so many of us, and then here they come. And since then, I've watched you guys with interest. Bruce, in particular, as the Vice President of Government Affairs, you're walking the halls of legislatures all over the country, or maybe inside the Beltway. Tell me a little bit about how all of that kind of what I'll call backroom negotiating takes place.
Yeah, we are. We get to any state that we can. You know, we can't be in all 50. Whether it's a committee meeting or meeting directly with representatives, the biggest challenge we have today, as Brian alluded to, the Humane Society, I mean, they've got hundreds of millions of dollars, and they've got lobbyists pretty much in all 50 states, and they really hammer the heck out of the legislators. And so we have to rely, we have to be a little bit more stealthy. and a little bit more quick, and not, you know, turn as slow as the wheels of government do. So we work with all of our partners, whether it's Turkey or NSSF and other groups, when legislation comes down, whether it's at the federal or state level, and we work with them on the grassroots level, grass tops, which is another term we use in my line on the government side, and that's kind of real influential people. So let's say you have a senator and his brother belongs to your local rod and gun club, and there's a piece of legislation that comes out, you know, we'll get our guys to hammer the brother to talk to his brother, who's the senator, and say, hey, this is bad for our people. Let me tell you why. So there's a lot of different tools we utilize when we fight these things, but it's not easy. They've got a lot of money. They've got a lot of energy, and their grassroots support systems is really well put together.
Let's get down to brass tacks here. You know, they say you can't enjoy the concert without a program. Who are the bad guys in this regard? Let's just make the list and check it twice when it comes to the folks who don't like what we do and don't want us to do it anymore. Brian, you want to chime in on that?
Number one, Humane Society of the United States. They're the largest anti-hunting organization in the world. You know, everybody thinks they are your local humane shelter. They're not. Your local humane shelter has nothing to do with Humane Society of the United States. They do not support one shelter in the nation. They're an advocacy organization that promotes veganism and anti-hunting. They don't think animals should be used for anything. They want us to be completely away from them. They're a $200 million a year organization.
I thought that was Wayne Pacelli's salary, by the way.
Yeah. Now they do some nice things there too, where they only give him X amount of salary, but then they give him stipends and a house and all that. But he's gone now, so that's good. He started a new organization, and so they're coming up and making inroads other places. So he's gone and started a new organization. He got caught up in the Me Too scandal last year, and the board actually didn't even fire him. After all these allegations came out, system-wide corruption, they didn't fire him. He stepped down the day after they voted to retain him. This is on top of the $16 million federal racketeering lawsuit that they paid off 10 years ago. You know, the Teflon, he's like the Teflon Don.
All right. On top of the HSUS, and you mentioned the fact that they don't support any animal shelters. Who else is in that, you know, the Derby Dozen?
Yeah. Center for Biological Diversity is a big one. Defenders of Wildlife is a big one. Born Free USA, they're out to stop all trapping. Sierra Club, of course. There's a whole list, but those are the big dogs that we continually run into out here in the West. Western Environmental, can't remember, is a law firm that then jumps up and represents different interests in these lawsuits, such as a grizzly lawsuit in Yellowstone, Western Environmental Foundation or something like that, based out of Montana. But those are the big ones: HSUS, Sierra Club, Defenders of Wildlife, Born Free, CBD, you know, those guys.
Center for Biological Diversity.
Yes.
Okay. You know, a lot of these, and I got to tell you, when I was in your business, Bruce, you know, there was some real art to coming up with a name for an organization that sounded like everybody should support it. And, you know, the perfect example is the Humane Society of the U.S., but there are others out there, and that's a perfect example right there. You know, it's got to be scary when you learn about a new organization for the first time and then realize what their true agenda was or is. So can you give us a heads up on maybe some of the fledgling organizations that we ought to probably keep an eye on, Bruce?
Well, interestingly enough, if you take a look at some of these smaller organizations, I'll give you a perfect example, is Project Coyote. You start to look at who their board members are and where their funding comes from. It's the Humane Society of the United States. So some of these organizations that are, you know, could be fledgling or something like that, they're very good about disguising, you know, who's supporting them, who the big donors are and stuff like that. You know, the Humane Society here recently, and I don't know the exact number, Brian might know that, you know, but their funding has dropped a little bit, and it could be because of all the scandals that have been going on. But a lot of times these new groups that pop up are only new in name, like you said. So something's not working, or they've been called out, they've been caught, people, they're showing their true colors. So they just create a new name, you know, and but it's the same old people. It's the same people funding it. It's the, you know, Soros of the world and those types of people that fund these. And they just, you know, if they're in a state, they've got an issue, you know, I'm sure we'll touch on it a little bit, but we've got these wildlife hunting contest bans that's under the guise of banning coyote contests. And that's where this Project Coyote comes out of. But when you do the research and you look to see who it is, it's the Humane Society. Their executive director, I think, is on the board, and a couple other people. So it's not so much that there's 80 different groups out there, individual groups. It's, you know, it's four or five of these big groups that have all these little tentacle groups out there, and they all claim to fight for something different. But at the end of the day, they just want to kill our heritage.
Right. There is a group out there that's rearing its head. It's been around for just a couple of years now, and it's called the Non-Human Rights Project. And these guys,
I'm sorry, yeah, I got to laugh at that. But it's not a laughing matter, is it?
No. These guys have stated that their ultimate goal is to secure human rights for non-humans. Point blank. They've started with these, what's called, you know, charismatic megafauna, elephants, great apes, etc., saying these guys, you know, deserve the same rights and captivity, their intelligence level, they're using different legal terms and, you know, historical legal arguments, perverting them slightly, which the law is always open to interpretation, so that can take place. They're starting there, but they make no bones about it. They're going to take that once it sets precedent, which, you know, you set precedent, then you just transfer that same argument over to something else. And yeah, that's so much of what we fight. We're a small organization, but we get involved in these court battles, and we have to pick, and we have to look at them. We can't fight every single battle out there because there's so many. But these big precedent-setting cases we get involved in, grizzly bears, wolves, public land in Alaska, which doesn't seem like much, but that sets precedent for all the public land, wildlife refuges and preserves in the West.
Yeah,
and so if you can change it here, you can change it there.
That's the scary part about the legal process. Once the Ninth Circuit Court rules on something, the Third Circuit and the First Circuit and the Fourth Circuit in New York, they're all going to go along with that unless there's something compelling that would convince them otherwise. So the whole idea of legal precedent is critical here. You know, let's get down to some of the things that are more directly applicable to bird dogs and bird hunters. And I'll never forget back in that day at the Elk Foundation gathering, where I sat in a room with hound hunters and fly fishers and big game hunters and archery hunters and trappers, and everybody thought, eh, who cares? It's just the hound hunters. I stood up and said something that I think was attributed to Benjamin Franklin first, and that is, if we don't all hang together, we will certainly hang separately. And this is coming back to haunt us in many ways these days, when it comes to using dogs for any aspect of hunting of any sort. It's not just hounds and cougars. It could be anything, right?
Exactly. You know, and we've seen it. We've seen it happen. California starts in California, and it moves its way up the West Coast to Oregon and then Washington, or vice versa, and then jumps over to the East Coast to the states on the coast there, Massachusetts, New Jersey, etc. And then they kind of make their way in. It's almost like a cancer. And California is usually the breeding ground for it. But that's exactly right, as far as we need to be sticking up for each other. And the hounds are the perfect example. You know, it's a niche group that, you know, doesn't get a lot of press, but boy, it's sure easy when they do get press to make them look bad. And that misinformation that gets put out costs dearly. And they've said it. Their plan is to remove, method by method, species by species, state by state. They don't care. They don't want to just stop hound hunting. They don't want to just stop baiting. They don't want to just stop trapping. They want to stop it all everywhere. And they're just moving from piece to piece. And then they'll transfer the same argument over to bird dogs. E-collars are going to be on the line. They already are in California.
And you're much of Europe, I believe, and even parts of Canada, if I recall correctly.
Oh, yeah. Whatever happens in Europe is going to find its way here. The animal rights movement originated in Europe. Mm-hmm. And whatever happens there, they're ahead of us on the bell curve. Whatever happens there will eventually find its way here. E-collars are pretty much illegal in Europe. There's places that there aren't, and there's different rules, but by and large, it's pretty much illegal. Public sentiment is completely against it, even trainers. I mean, I get in, if you're in the bird dog world at all, or, you know, that whole, the retriever world like I am, it's this big contentious deal. And even the trainers over there are like, oh, they're not necessary. They're not, it's just ignorance on, you know, how an e-collar is properly used and training methods. But whatever happens there eventually comes here. And they use that leverage. Look, all of Europe doesn't do it. They don't need it. This is unnecessary. It's cruel. And they get to use this emotional language. You know, the general public looks at Fido on the couch, who's overweight and doesn't do anything but eat and sleep and crap in the yard. And they go, yeah, you shouldn't have to be able to shock a dog. All they got to do is slap that on a ballot initiative and they can ban it.
Yeah, we've seen it happen in any number of areas. You know, let's delve a little bit deeper into the inside the beltway issues, Bruce, because these are the ones that we only hear about, frankly, when it's too late for us to do a lot as a bunch of schmoes out here at the roots end of the grass. Bruce, are there any of those that we need to know about now?
As far as upland stuff, at the federal level, nothing right now, but we are, there's a Cecil Act, if you remember Cecil mm-hmm. the Lion a couple of years ago. Rep Gravala, our good friend who now controls the Natural Resources Committee, has reintroduced that bill. The interesting thing is in that bill, they want the ability to list animals that potentially could be listed. So they want the protections. They want to create a group that basically says, in 5 years, you know, a hyenas could be on the list. So we just need to protect them now. So they're going even farther than even threatened or endangered with this bill. And maybe some of your listeners have been paying attention to the news recently. The administration, they rolled back some of the ESA stuff, particularly blanket rule. And that was previous to this rule change that's authorized by Congress, and it was done by the book. Any animal that was listed as threatened automatically had the prohibitions attached, so there was no take, anything like that. Well, Interior, you know, that's a hard thing to do, and what they would rather do is do it on a case-by-case basis. And a good example would be, let's say, you know, the wolverine becomes endangered, or they get it listed on there, but instead of there being you know, penalties for incidental take and stuff like that, they can do one-offs depending on the severity of the species listed. So Gravala and the antis, you know, there's 17 states suing now on that rule reversal. Their belief system is get it on the ESA and it'll never come off. Brian and I talk all the time. It's Hotel California. You can check in or check out, but you can't ever leave.
Boy, it brings back some not fond memories. You know, the whole grizzly question, of course, and then the wolf question, which I was a little bit involved in at one point. You know, those folks, they'll set a number, and then once we reach the number and the animal has to come off the list, then the number's not good enough anymore. That seems to be one of their modus operandi anymore.
Oh yeah, moving of the goalposts is their favorite tactic. I mean, nobody's arguing in the grizzly case or the Midwest wolf case that they aren't recovered. It's what's the impact going to be to the other distinct populations, the Northern Continental Divide for grizzly bears, wolves out here in the West. If you hunt them where they're recovered and something bad happens and the population gets knocked down, well, then the genetic diversity threat to the other populations is at risk. And so now they're making them go through a study to figure out how to do this and ensure that genetic diversity isn't going to impact other distinct populations.
Oh,
that's basically
boy.
What the argument is. So they just keep moving it. And then when U.S. Fish and Wildlife jumps through those hoops and gets those studies shown, the first time was White Park white bark pine beetles and white bark pine are dropping, and that's a major food source for the grizzly. It's not. The grizzly has like 256 different food sources it uses, and only uses those during a certain period, which it just substitutes. But they had to go in and show that they substitute this.
Wow.
They fulfilled that requirement. Now they're suing on this legal argument that it's going to impact the other distinct populations. So they just keep moving that goalpost, keep it tied up in court. They can afford to do that. It's tough for sportsmen's groups to counteract that because it's so expensive.
Speaking of sportsmen's groups, that is Brian Lind, and we've also got Bruce Tague on the line from the Sportsmen's Alliance. You're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. A whole bunch more, and if you don't think this is relevant to you, you've got another think coming. Believe me, we're going to get a little deeper into those weeds after a quick break. So hold on, guys. Take another sip of coffee, because now it's time to pay some of the bills around here, and then we'll be right back with our Handle It segment. Yeah, we are actually going to talk a little bit about dog training on this show as well. So stick around after this brief intermission. And let's welcome back our sponsor, Dakota 283. Of course, you can learn more about Dakota 283 at dakota283.com. They make some pretty innovative products, all roto-molded resins and plastic-like stuff, dog crates and kennels, food storage, gun storage, weatherproof, modular, all sorts of good stuff in that regard, a variety of colors, and all sorts of new lower prices. If you'd like to learn more about the new lower prices and some of the neat stuff out there, including their crates and kennels, which, well, I guess interchangeable, the term to me at least. What I like most about them is they've got bigger holes and your dog stays cooler. This time of year out in the field, hey, he probably will appreciate that. Learn more at Dakota283.com. And if you can't hear me very well, hello. Maybe you need to go to ESPAmerica.com. I'm using my custom-fitted ESP hearing protection devices in the field as well as on the range. One of the reasons I'm able to do that is, number one, they only protect you from those big bangs, but you can still hear the bird flush. You can still hear Flick's collar tags jingling in the distance, your buddy's bad story or corny joke. All of that works, but then when you pull the trigger, you're protected. Because remember, hearing loss is cumulative. The custom fit ensures that they're going to stay in your ear and not drop on the ground in the middle of South Dakota. Learn more at ESPAmerica.com. Yes, indeed, it is time for my favorite feature. This is where I get to share all the stuff I learned from folks who are smarter than me in our Handle It segment, all about dog training and dog care. In this case, George Hickox shared with me a way to simulate, you know, the wild bird thing if you can't access wild birds, but more importantly, to keep your dog steady on birds as they're flushing. Depending on where you want to be in that evolution, I'm hoping that Flick this year will be steady to wing, shot, and fall. One of the ways I'm doing that is with one of George's little tricks. I will plant two birds in the same spot, bring Flick into that spot, of course downwind, so that he actually points. Once he's pointed, then the real fun begins. Fly one of the birds. If he's steady, then you reward him. If he's not steady, you bring him back, and then fly the other bird. So what's the trick? Well, hopefully we're smarter than the dog, at least George is, maybe not me. So that dog is putting two and two together almost literally and saying, you know, if I run off, I'm never going to get that other bird, because there's always two birds in that spot. And if I want a reward, which is in this case a bird in my mouth, I probably ought to hang around for that second flush, that second shot, and that second fall. Thanks to George Hickox. What a great guy, and very helpful to people like you and me. And if you'd like to learn more, head over to the Upland Nation podcast page, where I have links to all of that kind of stuff, and you can learn more about all of those kind of guys. All right, with that in mind, let's get down and dirty again with our friends from the Sportsman's Alliance. Brian, Bruce, you back there with me, and did you learn anything?
Yes, sir.
Great tip from George.
Great tip.
You know, one of the things that scares me most about the anti-hunting and so-called animal rights folks is their perverted logic. And there's never a straight line from A to B to C. They start at A and then they go to X and then they come back to W or something like that. But Brian, in an earlier conversation, we talked about taxidermy and how that might actually be a sore spot in the coming months or years. Can you explain a little bit how my taxidermied trophy pheasant might become problematic?
This is great, and this is another trick they use, and this relates to the Cecil bill, you know, that we were talking about. We already see this happen in New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, related to African game, and this is why the average hunter in North America, the whitetail guy, the pheasant guy, we need to defend these other types of methods and places. You may never want to go to Africa, but here's what's happening. Individual states, and then at the national level, the groups are trying to stop the importation of lions, giraffes, leopards, buffalo, whatever, the big five. As a average Joe guy who's never going to go there, and he'd be like, I don't care, let it happen. Well, what's happening at the state level is they're saying, even if you legally take those animals in Africa and you import them and it's okay at the federal level, you can't transport them across state lines. And you can't bring them into Connecticut or New York. If you do, it's a misdemeanor or a felony. Some of them were felonies when they were first proposed. When you do that, now you have a patchwork of where your taxidermy is legal, and you're in trouble if you bring it across. If they can do that at the state level with an animal that was legally harvested elsewhere and then taxidermied, they can do it with deer, with birds, with anything else. They can just now pivot and use the same legal arguments as they used for African game. When you throw in that the deer and elk with chronic wasting disease, EHD, other types of diseases, there's already a pushback about transporting. You already can't import some birds from South America because of fear of disease. It's a easy, small, short argument to leap from A to C with their logic and with their ability to push these, get media, and put lawmakers in their back pocket. That's how they're going to do it.
Death of a thousand cuts. And Bruce, go ahead, but don't let me forget to ask you another question after this. Go.
Sure. I just want to go back to what Brian said. That is of extreme alarm, should be extreme alarm to all of our folks. Brian mentioned, you know, a lot of these taxidermy type pieces of legislation were felonies. The eight bills this year, every one of them started out as a felony. Florida, okay, the majority of the New York, Connecticut, that dealt with African stuff. Florida, there was a legislator down there that snuck in black bear. So she wanted to end the black bear season in Florida. So she put a piece of legislation out there to possess ivory, which everyone says, okay, I don't really go over there, but put black bear taxidermy in there as well as a felony. I'm sure all of our listeners know if you get convicted of a felony, 9 times out of 10, you lose your voting rights. You lose your right to bear arms. Okay. Most of us, when we're out in the field, we're toting a shotgun, right? Or a rifle. They're getting very smart with these. And I can't stress enough how important it is for folks to understand. Just like Brian said, you may say, well, I can't afford to go to Africa. You know, I'll never be able to bring a black rhino home. Well, if you're convicted of a felony with a black bear here in Florida, in this case, fortunately it died. We were successful in killing it, but you're getting slapped with a felony. And that's part of the, it's an all-encompassing thing. They're trying to figure out every possible way they can keep people out of the field.
Well, speaking of, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Speaking of keeping us out of the field, one of the things that a lot of us do is, you know, every couple, 3 years, one of our females gets bred, and we want to offer up what we think are pretty darn good puppies to our friends and neighbors and maybe some fellow hunters across the country. it's not so simple anymore, because depending on where you live, and even down to the city level, you may be considered a puppy mill. I mean, what's the risk in that regard for any of us who are just innocent dog breeders once in a while?
Yeah, that's very important too, and I was going to get into that, and I'm glad you asked me. We're actually New Hampshire. There's a member of the legislature up there, former congressman, who is a darling child of the Humane Society, changed the definition up there from a commercial kennel to a quote pet vendor, and put in there that if you transfer 25 or more animals, you're considered a pet vendor, which then jumps up and you're required to have inspections and all this. Now, most of our folks, I mean, that's a threshold. I mean, potentially two litters, right? Could be 25 pups. And our folks are not in this, as commercial breeders to make money. This is for good bloodlines. We want solid animals. But that's the mission creep that we talk about. And we're seeing these animal thresholds become more and more common, along with tethering time limits. And of course, you know, they want the kennel and shelter requirements to be, you know, like a Marriott hotel. And those really are the, you know, in these coyote contests that they've put out there. They start out coyote contests, but the language says wildlife. It includes everything, but that'll affect field trials.
Well, among other things, you're absolutely right. Go there, because I got some other examples of that.
Yeah. So, you know, they put these wildlife killing contests, what they call them. And then when you kind of hammer them a little bit, they say, well, we really just want to get rid of the coyotes. You know, we don't want the coyote killing contest. Well, when you look at the language in there, any field trial, it would technically be illegal based on that, because a dog is given a ribbon or a prize or whatever. Sometimes there's, you know, sometimes there's game that's been harvested. I mean, they're not dumb. This language isn't just something that they threw together and, oh, wow, guess what? You know, it looks like it covers a bunch of other stuff. I'll give you a perfect example. In New York, was wildlife. It would have banned big buck contests. It would have banned turkey shoots. Would have banned all of that. We're working real hard up there to work on that bill. And they, believe it or not, in New York, we were able to slowly chip away at that. But the way that bill was initially written, if Brian, you and myself decided to go out and I said to you, hey, I bet, you know, steak dinner to the guy who gets the biggest buck, the way that language was written, all three of us could be thrown in jail, whatever their charges were at the time. If you promoted it on Facebook, I'm originally from upstate New York, real small town in upstate New York, and our volunteer firefighters that I was part of as well, we had a big buck contest a couple times, and our local mayor and even our village police chief, would tell people about it. Well, under this new law in New York, promoting, if the mayor at the time had Facebook, or right now put Facebook, you know, go support the local volunteer fire department at the turkey shooter, the big buck contest, he'd be arrested just for promoting. So it's scary.
It's the same. And that was the same in Oregon. It's not just the crazy Northeast Yankees that are doing it. Same language that was in Oregon, wildlife. Well, and depending on where you look in the code, it doesn't matter if it was a pen-raised duck or chucker,
right?
That's still considered wildlife. It was conflicting. So then it gets down to how good a mood is the game warden in that day, the prosecutor, and the judge. Are you going to risk everything on those guys, whether they're enforcing it to the letter of the law or not?
And let's remember that some of those people are elected officials, and they serve their constituents, not the general public as a whole. I'm going to go off on a slight tangent, but it's really what makes this all most relevant to our listeners here at the Upland Nation podcast, and that is, in the last year or two, I've probably broken those laws had they been in effect for any number of reasons, and here's just a short list. Any long-tailed pheasant contest that you entered at the local Ace Hardware store is probably going to be a violation under some of those laws. I was invited to the governor's hunt in South Dakota, Kansas, and then the Sharktail shootout in Nebraska, and all of those so-called events could be defined as contests with prizes of all sorts under some of this legislation you're talking about. We would all be lawbreakers, and some of us would be, unfortunately, made the example of for everybody else. You got to remember, quite often, as you know very well, both of you guys, they're always looking for test cases and scapegoats. And so somebody's going to have to be the test case someday, and it's going to be on something like that, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, it's funny that you brought that up about breaking the law. So the legislator in New York who sponsored this bill, when asked in a radio interview after we turned our machine on, said, you know, what's your response to a father and a son going out and the father saying to the son or daughter, hey, whoever gets more squirrels, you know, I'll buy you a candy bar. Her response was, that's not what the intent of this is. And we don't believe that New York State Department of Environmental Conservation officers will be enforcing something like that. To which my answer is, it's against the law. So it doesn't, you can't pick and choose and say, here's the law. Oh, by the way, Mr. NCON officer, if you see a father and his son and daughter and they're out there and or you overhear them at the local diner, just let that go. Because all of us who are ethical and follow the law, we wouldn't do that because it'd be illegal. And just the mindset of, well, we're not worried about that. Okay, well, if you're not worried about that, then make sure the language in the law states, here's what a contest means. But they're not interested in that. They would just want to shut it all down.
Oh, I agree, and it scares me, and I know it from the inside out, having worked in both of your worlds quite a while ago, but it sounds like things haven't changed. One more issue, and you alluded to it a while ago, and that is, you know, when we're hunting, when we're training, when we're trialing or going to a hunt test, a lot of us will use either a chain gang or a tie-out stake. And whether it's at home, in the front yard, backyard, or on a hunt, there are people who don't think that that ought to be allowed. Where's the rationale in that?
Yeah. A lot of this. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead, Brian.
I was just going to say, you know, a lot of this, sometimes it's well-meaning. You know, sometimes you just have an ignorant legislator who gets something thrown up to them, and they're like, okay, yeah, I'll back that. Most of the time it's not. Most of the time it is a backdoor attempt to stop this stuff. But a lot of what we see, the puppy mill bills, like we talked about, transfer of 25 dogs, you know, can being considered now a pet vendor and regulated like PetSmart. That, I just wanted to bring this up, the verbiage is very important. That didn't say breeding or selling puppies. That said transfer. So if you're training, your trainers, your local trainer that you send your dog to, if he transfers 25 dogs in a year, which is pretty darn easy to do, that constitutes that. And now he's under all this heavy regulation, is the same as PetSmart or anybody else. But a lot of this is aimed at puppy mills. It's aimed at the dog that is tied in the front yard and left on a chain for its whole life. Like, nobody wants to see that, right? But blanket regulation rarely works. And that would affect your field trialers, your guys, you know, you put your dog on the stakeout chain, you have your whole chain of dogs out there, and they say, well, we're going to get around, you know, a blanket by saying, you know, putting temperatures on it. If it's at 32 degrees or 90 degrees, they can't be out there. If you're not home, they can't be out there unsupervised, things like that. That still screws us all up. You know, you mentioned that putting them on a drop chain. Retriever guys, like I put my dog in the backyard, I still put him on a tether so he can't dig out or somebody can't just come in and lift him out. That's illegal. A lot of it is meant to be well-being, but again, enforced to the letter of the law, that ends all of those practices.
Yeah, and a lot of these legislators that Brian, you know, has referred to, they don't understand that it is essential that our dogs get acclimated to the weather conditions they're going to be hunting in. They could be jumping in almost freezing cold water to retrieve something. They could be running around in the hot sun. To leave an animal out tethered for only 15 minutes, which is what some of these language is in some of these states is you can't leave them out more than 15 minutes if they're unattended or out of your eyesight. You know as well as I do, you can't acclimate a dog at 15 minutes a rip. You just can't do it. And so they don't understand that, one, these dogs are bred for this. Two, if they're not acclimated, there's a higher chance that that animal's going to get injured when they're out in the field because it's either too cold, too warm. Their body's just not used to the conditions that they work in. And so, you know, like Brian said, sometimes it's well-intentioned, but you can't just make these blanket rules and regulations, you know, based on the kind of knee-jerk or, you know, reaction seeing the, you know, the Humane Society's ad out there with the, you know, this little dog chained up to a fence, you know, with a little bit of snow on the doghouse. They just don't understand the needs of working dogs.
And it's usually based on arbitrary human reconciliation. Oh, it's 32 degrees out. It's freezing outside. I'm cold if I go out there. You go out there. Humans and dogs aren't equivalent.
Yeah, that's the Disneyfication of
Disneyfication.
Wildlife and domestic animals, for that matter. Guys,
that's right.
You deal with it every day. I remember back in the day when I was the guy across the table from the PETA folks debating them on television. How do we deal with these people in our everyday lives? What is the best way for us to kind of handle encounters with people like this?
Well, it depends if you're talking, you know, the PETA types, the rabid, you know, anti-hunter animal rights activists, you're not going to change their mind. All right. So I deal with it on social media a lot. You're not going to change their mind. What you want to influence are the people who are watching, the people who are listening. So just keep poking holes in their argument. You know, one of my favorites is they all say, well, the humans are the problem. You know, don't go into the grizzly bear habitat or something of that nature. And it's like, okay, well, then you're either advocating for genocide or you're not dealing in reality. So which is it? There's people. We're not going anywhere. The answer is we have to manage, and we manage from the land up. Predators, prey, in balance with the ecosystem. Educate the non-hunter. That's what everything that we fight in a ballot initiative, legislation is, so much of it is due to ignorance, not understanding how an ecosystem actually works, not understanding the role that the hunter plays in conservation, land management, in funding state wildlife agencies. 80% of all 50 state wildlife agencies are supported by the Pittman-Robertson Act, Johnson-Dingle Act, and the purchasing of tags and licenses. All that goes away. But people don't know that. It's a long story to tell. And we don't tell it well enough and often enough for people to understand it when the headline comes up. Eliminate hound hunting. Eliminate e-collars. They're cruel. It's mean. Animals are slaughtered. We all know that's not real. That's not true. And that's not how it works. But when you're facing emotion, our long story doesn't work, so we have to tell that story before it happens. So don't get emotional when you're arguing with somebody. Realize you're not going to change their mind, but educate those who are watching and listening.
The Socratic method works pretty darn well. I joke about it. I've used it so much over the years, but if you ask anybody like that five questions, you'll probably make them at least start thinking about the issue a little bit more carefully. In this whole Pittman-Robertson thing, we just discussed that. In fact, that's the latest podcast. So if you're at the podcast page, go down and find that one from Ed Carter, who runs the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies. Great primer on how hunters ought to take pride in the fact that they're funding virtually every aspect and most of it when it comes to wildlife management and conservation. Let's kind of wrap things up, guys, on a high note. Let's talk about some of the victories we've had in this regard in the last few years that may not have come across unless we had a higher level of awareness and a lot of people really working hard, guys like you. Bruce, you want to kick this one off?
Sure. We can start out with some of these coyote contest victories that we just had this year. Nevada, we were able to kill that one. Oregon, obviously, we touched on that one. That one got killed. But they're not going away. So we've got to keep, you know, we've got to keep our guard up and watch these legislatures in the states. New York, again, we're continually to whittle away on that one. You know, if you take a look at the map as well, you will see that there's certain states, certain bad players like California. I mean, heck, they just recently banned all recreation and commercial trapping. It's done. It's gone to California. It's probably never going to get back. But we know the states where the legislature is you know, really working against us. And you know, we've got some small wins in there. I can list off a bunch, but there's still a lot that's going on. We got some stuff done in Connecticut, these big five bans that we discussed a little bit earlier.
On the other side is the ballot initiative. Like, we work every year, every session in all 50 states, but the ballot initiatives is a favored tactic. You know, Oregon, Washington, California. They've done all of these banned hound hunting, banned trapping, you know, and they've done it by ballot initiative. Humane Society of the United States comes in, starts a group, and it's their people running it, and they give 97% or to 99% of the funding comes directly from Washington, D.C. And that's where you get into the issue in, you know, the I-5 corridor along the West Coast versus the eastern half of the states. Mm-hmm. And it's just a popular opinion contest.
Well,
and
what
it's really easy to manipulate.
Oh, I know. I would. I've lived that.
You know, and we work there too. So our most recent victory was in Montana a couple of years ago when they tried to ban trapping on public land. You know, and that is actually a tough fight, even in Montana, someplace like Montana. You know, and it's they just come in and they can self-fund it and run it. So we walked in and we were, you know, we headed up the group and said, okay, here's the messaging. Here's where we need to fight. And, you know, that was the most recent one. Consider that half of the wolf harvest in Montana comes from trapping on public land and what that would do to herds, cattle, and everything else if it was taken away.
All right. Yeah, so go ahead, Bruce.
Yeah, no, just a couple more for your listeners. There was a Maryland bill on tethering with temperatures above 90 degrees and below 32. We were able to kill that one. Texas, same sort of deal. They wanted to put an exemption for hunting dogs in there, but we were able to kill the bill outright. Another Texas one was unattended, have access to water. We were able to kill that one. There was a Virginia bill. There was a Florida bill kind of on the puppy mill side that was dealing with animal thresholds again. We were able to kill that one. In that particular piece of legislation, they wanted to allow no more than 50 sexually intact females above the age of 6 months. We were able to kill that one. Here's one more scary thing that we saw, and fortunately we were able to kill this one too, but in Rhode Island, they wanted to create an animal abuse registry, kind of like a sexual predator registry. And so if you had broken one of their animal cruelty laws, which some of the stuff was just like not adequate water or something like that, could have been, you know, not animal abuse, but they had some pretty lenient things on there. And you would have lost your animal. You'd have been publicly shamed. They'd had a website with your picture, put your address on there. And here's where the scary part is. If you were to appeal that, they would keep your name on that list until your appeal was done. Keep your animals until your appeal was done. If you were successfully, your appeal went through and they said, you know what, we made a mistake, we're sorry, that damage was already done. Your face and your address was listed publicly by the Attorney General on their webpage, just like the sexual predators are. I mean, that's pretty scary if you think about it.
Oh gosh, yeah,
and there's flag laws, right?
So much of that out there, guys. If we as just sportsmen, bird hunting sportsmen, dog owning sportsmen, were to do one or two basic things in our world to support your efforts. Of course, send you money, but the broader base. What should we know, or what should we do?
We need to get out of this thought process of, well, hounds, I don't hound hunt, I don't care. It doesn't affect me. It's going to affect you. There is absolutely zero difference between turning a hound loose, tracking a bear or a mountain lion, as there is turning a bird dog loose, going after a pheasant or chucker.
Bruce, how about yourself?
It's going to sound like an echo chamber, but that's exactly it. When we're fighting these things all over the country, I try to get the broadest coalition I can. Sometimes it's not even sportsmen's groups. It might be the Farm Bureau. It might be a local chamber of commerce that affects them somehow. Maybe it's economic or on the farm sign, predators and stuff like that. But we've got to come together and fight because they're just chipping away. They go for the low hanging fruit. Typically that's trapping. But then it just keeps snowballing. And Brian is 100% right. He and I talk about it all the time. We're the only group that defends all hunting, fishing, and trap. We don't discriminate. We don't care what your method is. We don't care what your passion is. If it's legal, we're going to defend you. Sometimes it's difficult. We get that. Well, I don't hound hunt, so what the heck do I care? Well, when that's gone, they need another target. You might be next.
Yeah.
And then you have to be politically active. Bitching about it to your buddy in the cab of the truck on the way to turn the dogs loose isn't going to do anything. You have to reach out to your representatives, to your senators, to anybody and everybody, and make noise. That's what the other side does. They make noise in the media with emotional language. We have to make noise to the policymakers to make sure they understand what's at stake and how this is going to fall out.
The pack that we need to form should be called Squeaky Wheels, because it is absolutely true. I've seen it. And on that note, I think we're gonna have to turn you guys loose. I know I've got to turn those guys loose across the table from me. But we'll learn more at sportsmensalliance.org. That's sportsmensalliance.org, although anybody can go there. Guys, you're doing a great job. Like I said, way back in the day when you were first getting started, I was first getting started in that world as well. And it was an interesting ride, to say the least. Bruce Tagg and Brian Lynn from Sportsman's Alliance, keep up the good work. We're behind you 100%. Thanks for being on the Upland Nation podcast.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
All right, and hang on, because in just a moment here, we will jump into the what's my favorite subject these days, public land hunting. It's free. Right after this quick message from our friends at Dogtra, you know how I feel about their new T&B dual collar system. Two collars, use them any way you like. Two dogs, one dog front and rear, depending on what you're teaching. One handheld device where you do not need to toggle back and forth from dog to dog, collar to collar. There are two parallel sets of buttons, so when you want to tone one dog and vibrate the other one, it's right there. Two fingers, same control. I love mine. Now, there are also some great things about being an Upland Nation listener. Number one, free shipping on any purchase over $200. That's good for anybody. But also 10% off if you're on the Upland Nation podcast and you mention the coupon code SLUN10. SLUN, Scott Linden, Upland Nation, 10 will get you another 10% off. Free shipping always. Dogtra.com is where you learn more about this incredible device. And I'm using it every day with Flick. He is learning not only to be steady with that collar on his flank, but also to retrieve to hand reliably with another collar on his neck. You'll be learning more about how I'm doing that as the season goes on. At least I hope. Yeah, and that's my cue for this land is your land. I know it is. It's an obvious statement, but it's absolutely correct. You know, there is so much publicly accessible ground out there, including in New Mexico. If you watched Wing Shooting USA a year or so ago, you saw us having a good time near Deming, New Mexico. Yeah, all the time we were trying to get to Arizona to hunt some of those less common quail species, we ended up, ironically, in New Mexico, had a great time. Deming is the hotbed. Silver City is close by as well. Both of those places are great because you can access so much Bureau of Land Management, federal land open to hunting. If your species is gambel's quail, Mearns quail, scaled quail, cotton tops, whatever you call them, you know, they're all there in various locations. Just drive into that yellow patch on the topographical map, park somewhere, and have a good time. You'll find the gambels and the scalies in the dry creek beds. They call them arroyos down there. Usually on the western slopes of the mountain ranges. There's a whole bunch of little mountain ranges out there, just like much of the Great Basin. Look to the western slopes for those gambels and scalies. I've also found them at water sources of various sorts. If you see a windmill in the distance or you hear about a stock pond, well, I would head for those at some point during my hunt. The biggest covey of scaled quail I ever saw flew off of a dripping stock watering trough fed by a windmill in, well, of all places, that was down in that same area. Now, if you're looking for Mearns in particular because they're on your life list, head for the Gila Mountains, and down there, Gila is spelled G-I-L-A. Watch the sandy soil. They scratch for bulbs to eat, so that's where I would do the start of my hunt. It's not your normal hunt. It's a lot of run and gun. Get in shape and make sure your dogs are protected from the heat and from the cactus. Be safe out there. Enjoy yourself. And I'll see you in New Mexico. All right, this part of the podcast is brought to you by our newest sponsor, Tag Safari. Their website is brand new, tagsafari.com. They've revamped the website because they've added a whole bunch of other product lines, everything from apparel, which is where they got their start, to books, gifts, home goods, and a little bit of everything else, all in the kind of the hunter and the Ernest Hemingway vein. Tag Safari got its start, and it's still strong by using almost virtually wholly made in Africa products. They grow the cotton, they spin it, they weave it. They make the packaging out of homegrown African products, and then they ship it over here where we can support the African economy and all of the independent folks and the employees over there at Tag Safari. It's an incredible concept. The stuff is incredibly well made. It will be heirloom product for you and your heirs on down the line. TagSafari.com. Learn more about them there. And then learn more about Dogtra and the new T&B dual collar at dogtra.com. Free shipping and 10% off if you use the coupon code SLUN10. All right, so if you want some new gear, here's your chance. It's time for the Upland Trivia question. This week's prize, a Sage and Breaker Mercantile gun cleaning mat. Boy, oh boy, everybody's going to be jealous when you roll that thing out on your tailgate. If you want to enter this contest, go to scottlindenoutdoors@gmail.com and send me your answer. Here's the question. On your dog's front legs, yeah, think about it. I'm looking at mine right now. There's a pad about halfway between his foot and his elbow. Some people call it the thumb, and that's probably a good one, but that's not the term I'm looking for. Slightly more scientific or veterinary term for that pad about halfway between his foot and his elbow. What's it called? Email your answer to scottlindenoutdoors@gmail.com. And that will do it for the Upland Nation podcast. Until I talk with you next on the podcast, of course, I invite you to watch the television show Wing Shooting USA. You can learn more about all of us at the uplandnation.com website or at my Facebook page, Wing Shooting USA, among others. Yeah, talk to me, give me some guest suggestions, some topics to cover. Got a question? Never know, we might be able to answer it. If I don't, then everybody else on Facebook will certainly give you their 2 cents worth. I hope if you enjoy the Upland Nation podcast, you'll leave a review on whatever place you download it from, because that's how we get moved up on the list so other people just like us will listen as well. It's a great time of year for all of us. I know you're getting psyched. I am beyond that point. I am looking forward to the adrenaline rush of Saturday morning. So is Flick. Someday we'll see you in the field. And until then, thank you so much. I'm Scott Linden, your host. Thanks for listening.